This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is June 12th, the year 2001. I'm on the east side of Madison on Fordham Avenue at Wally Welker's apartment, and we're going to be talking about Wally's career at the University of Wisconsin. But before we get to Wisconsin, Wally, let's go back a little bit and talk about your childhood and your early schooling. Could you just give us some information about that time of your life, please?
Well, I was raised on a farm and did a lot of chores. It had to be done. My father used my brother and I for work, and so we had a lot of chores, but we also, which were onerous, and we, in our free time, we would play. And play for me always took on the form of dealing with the playing in the sandbox and constructing things and doing things with visual features of the environment and looking at sand particle sizes and things like that. And we, there was a creek running through the bottom of our farm, and we'd run around, look at little animals in that, and a floating algae and anything we could look at, pebbles and rocks.
Where was the farm?
It's in eastern New York State, northeastern New York State, about 25 miles east of Buffalo, New York.
What was the name of the community?
It was Darien Center.
Darien Center. And how many, you had your father and your mother, how many sibs did you have?
My sister, my brother, who was younger, my sister was older, brother was younger, and we had a, I had an older brother who died at nine of rheumatic fever.
Okay. So continue.
My sister spent all her time in the house with my mother. She was doing female things, and my brother and I worked in the barn. And then our free time, we were, my dad let us do whatever we wanted, as long as there weren't chores to be done. And that's when we'd roam the farm. The farm was sort of, it was 820 acres, went back a mile or so from the road, which is US 20, to a mile back where we had a maple woods. Sugar maple wood, and we used to go back there and wander around and look at all the plants and animals and just the wildness of it. Mm-hmm. There was a swamp back there which made it seem surreal and primitive, and we were visualizing early dinosaurs, you know, wandering around the swamp. And and when we wandered, one of the chores was to chase the cows from the barn through a long lane all the way back towards the woods where there was a pasture. That would get them out of the way and get them outside, and they could get back to feeding grounds. And I would usually do this by myself. Since I was the oldest boy, and I'd herd the cows along this lane, and we'd go back there. I would sing Home, Home in the Range, or some simple thing. And just sort of daydreamed and watched the rear ends of cows go ahead of me. There was a terminal glacial area in New York State, and there were, to clear off the fields, the farmers, my dad and the farmers in the four had hauled all the boulders and rocks off of the fields into this lane, the side of the lane, and stacked them into a long corridor of boulders and rocks, and we used to walk across those and get our early agility, and that was a fun adventure. That lane led back. We locked the cows in the gate, and then the lane went straight back to the woods, the maple woods, and that's where we would wander around, and that's where I first had my first imagery, or first thoughts about details of the environment. Mm-hmm.
And you're being just surrounded by the environment,
yeah,
pretty much at all points in time. Yeah,
huge trees. And in the early spring, February and March, when there was just snow back there, we used to go back as the spring began to appear, sap begin to flow in the maple trees, it would tap with a rotary drill, would tap a hole on the right side and tap in a spigot. It had a little, on which there was a hook that would hang a pail. And that's where we would collect the sap. And back there, there was a rending, evaporating evaporator, maple syrup evaporator. And we had a boat that had a 100-gallon tank on it that would drive around the woods and empty the sap buckets into that boat. Horses, two horses would pull it back towards the evaporator house shed. And then we had two huge vats, 4 by 4 by 10 feet, and sap would pour into those things, and they had spigots coming out that would which could be tapped off it and lead the sap inside the building, which is a huge long furnace, a standard evaporator furnace for maple syrup. And it would father would show us how to stoke the furnace with wood and skim off the scum of debris that would be as the stuff, the sap was boiling, and it'd lean in at the back end of the furnace, and you'd get it through channels up towards the front where it was thicker and closer to the syrup stage. And as the front vat got, there was a series of chambers, and as the front chamber got, as the sap got thicker and thicker, you touched it by lifting the dipper up and watch it drip. And then when it started to get sticky and taffy-like, then you'd lead it off into a 10-gallon can through a felt strainer. Strain out most of the rest of the debris, and you'd get maple syrup going into the 10-gallon can. And there was a bench back there, and you'd have to stay with it all night long. And when I was old enough, I would do this by myself.
Oh my.
And it was a wonderful experience. The smell of the evaporating sap, and steam going out through the top. It was a vented ceiling. And you had a shed nearby that was attached where you'd bring in the firewood to keep the fire going. And it was always, you had to keep fiddling with the fluids to keep them moving forward towards the front, not let them burn, keep skimming off of debris that would accumulate.
So you were, during your work hours, that was part of your work hours, you were surrounded by a natural environment.
In February.
But throughout the entire year with your duties with the cows and the
pretty much
farm life in general.
Lawn life.
Yeah. And then during your play hours, you and your sibs would go off and you would do more of this. So you had the natural world surrounding you. Not like a kid today sitting in front of a computer playing computer games.
Okay. And we had a dog usually, so we had companionship for that kind.
When did you start getting interested, and let's keep you outside, we'll put you in school in a few minutes, but when did you start getting interest, consciously aware of studying in some sort of, I hate to say systematic, but observational way of the natural world?
It was that time when I was lying on the floor of the forest during the summer when there wasn't any work back there to do. It was just a place to go for reverie. And that's when I began to look at all the different features of the plant life, and the dirt and the pebbles, and looking at the trees, realizing different trees had different bark patterns, and the beech, and birch, and maple trees, plus ironwood trees, and a whole bunch of other varieties of hardwoods, and each had a different bark pattern, different leaves. And as I became more and more aware of these kinds of differences in the natural world, became curious as to the causes why this is so. And I've talked to other people since in recent years, and most people didn't have that kind of curiosity. They weren't curious about, you had curious about what's beyond the stars. I had that too, but it was sort of a hard one to deal with because it was, mm-hmm. there was no end. But dealing up close with visual stuff, it was easy to count and to detect colors and shades and saturation patterns.
What about your schooling at this point? Did this reinforce that?
I don't remember that. The curiosity about subject matter in books came later, and mm-hmm. It started with the natural world, and I think at school I was in like junior high, and later grade school I was more or less a prankster or a clown and rebellious, and teachers would throw erasers at me. I was constantly yakking or not attending, that kind of thing. But in the second sophomore year of high school, I began to realize that I was becoming more socialized. I started playing basketball, and I played in the band and trombone. And I joined the choir. I started to get more interested in having more and more experiences and things. I became much more interested in people, and I wasn't person to make judgments. I would just take them however they were. So I didn't form cliques with kids of any age or any kind. And I tried to make friends with everybody. And this was fun because I learned techniques of socializing. Mm. Even with the grade school kids on the first floor of our high school, Alexander High School, little kids, I'd get to know them as individuals, and they used to say, "Hi, Wally," and I became popular just because of my interest in individuals and not judgmental way of viewing other folks. I guess that's the way I've always approached things in general, not judging people on any of their behaviors or manners or appearances. I was very sensitive to people who were fat or who were being ribbed by mm-hmm. kids, or people who had unusual features that made them outstanding and appear subject butts of jokes. And I wouldn't go along with that. I would always try to befriend people who were. So I had non-judgmental attitude towards everything, which to go into the fields I did.
Well, right. I was going to say, in science, wouldn't you want to go in with a non-judgmental attitude and not think just because that thing happened to have a big nose, it wasn't going to be good or something like that? Yeah, I can understand that. What about, did you have any teachers in particular in the grades or in high school who kind of turned you on to schooling or directed you toward this area, toward your area?
Several people. There was a chemistry teacher who was sort of clumsy and set up some kind of a chemical experiment, and it would blow up or something would go wrong. And he'd say, "Oops," as if he didn't expect it. And we all sort of laughed at him in a way. But the experiments he set up were striking, and I became interested in chemistry and shapes of different bottles and Rotemeyer flasks and all that, test tubes, and I was fascinated by the ability to be able to mix chemicals and get different things from them.
By striking, do you mean dramatic experiments?
Some of them were just new to me. The fact that you could mix two different white fluids, transparent fluids, and you get a colored fluid. Mm-hmm. And he had in the chemistry closet, he had all the major elements, including sodium and potassium, stored in oil. So they wouldn't spontaneously hurry, take out a little bit of sodium and throw it in the sink, and it would those experiences struck me, and I became interested in chemistry very early. Not in any deep sense, but that here was the structure of matter, and these isolated atomic elements. the fact that things are all made up of compounds. So the chemistry teacher was pointing out these similar facts that wood was had all these fiber structures, and he explained it in simple terms so that we could visualize how wood was constructed. And we had some simple botany classes, zoology classes, just sections of animals. And these were fascinating to me. I had a mathematics teacher who was a real old lady, and very stern, old maid type woman. But she was very strict about trying to teach us arithmetic and our algebra, and later calculus. And I found those difficult subjects, but her, she seemed to be a wise person, and I respected her a lot. I felt that she had a lot to teach, and that there was much there to learn, even though I didn't know where it was going to go or why one would learn it.
What about your parents? What grades had they attained? What's the highest grade level for each of them?
I think my father never graduated from high school. He ran away as a young man to join the circus.
Oh, really? I thought people only did that in stories.
He played a piccolo, and I think he had 10 brothers and 3 sisters, and a tyrannical father, and I think he became a hard man himself, but he also was rebellious, and he ran away and found his own freedom. And I remember my brother and I, my brother's professor at Northwestern, we were very much alike. Our writing is the same. It's the same as our father's, no scribbly, hardly read it. And but we both had this lust for escape, you know, from routine things. And that has been true of me all my life.
What about your mother? How far did she get?
She went to a normal school somewhere in central New York, Cortland, or Buffalo, one of those, some 2-year college type schools that you went to be a teacher. She became a teacher, and she taught for a while in these little country schools, some of them which are still there, little old red schoolhouses with overgrown ivy and falling apart. I don't know much about that time in her life, but because she started having children, and that sort of occupied her completely. My father was very traditional, expecting the wife to do all house chores and all that.
What was your parents' attitude towards school? What were their expectations of you and
your
brother?
They thought we had to go to school. We also had to go to church. They didn't do it, but
Oh, interesting.
I think they were trying to make us better people. We didn't have a lot of books at home, so that we maybe had a bookcase the size of that one with just a few books in them. Wizard of Oz and some of those simple children's books. And there may have been some others, but I don't remember either of them reading. My father read the newspaper. My mother was too busy. My father was a musician. He was musically inclined. He ran away to the circus, the piccolo. He picked up instruments of various kinds and was fluent with them, or at least thought he was. And he learned to play all kinds of reed and brass instruments. And he wanted all of us to learn some instrument, which we did. My mother played piano. We always had a upright piano. And we would, she played piano, my father would play clarinet or saxophone. My sister took up trumpet, so did my brother, and then I. And my sister graduated to saxophone. But he wanted us to play as a family. And he tried to drill us in the basics of music, how to read and play and timing and all that. And he was very irritable if we didn't do it right, you know, so he was very harsh. And none of us have ever played an instrument since we left home, played in high school. But,
when you finished high school, we have the military coming up, so your college waits for a few years yet, but did you expect at that point to continue on to a college, take college courses, enroll in college?
Yes, in my junior year, I realized that I wanted to become very serious academically, and then I started to read. We had a small library, maybe the size of this room, loaded with books, and I used to read all kinds of stuff that I could read, and took like biological subjects, dinosaurs and animal anatomy and stuff like that. I'm sorry, I'm coming hoarse, but it's, I hope this picks up. So I started to become a serious student and to try to get good grades and everything. I studied hard as a junior, and as a senior, I studied even harder. I wanted to succeed and become proficient in these different subjects. And I took a variety of different subjects. They didn't teach, I taught regular geometry, but they didn't teach solid geometry. But my old lady mathematics teacher gave me a solid geometry book, and I took it, and I passed the New York Regents.
Oh, really?
Just on my own with her guidance. And so I had a curiosity for that kind of abstruse subject matter. And we had civics classes and some language classes, but not very much. I'd learned typing. And so there was some young female teachers at that time who were good teachers, I think. I took them seriously, so that they said to do this and I would do this. The end of the junior and into the senior year, I was a very serious student. And I became very popular because of all my social things I was doing. I think it was like I was maneuvering myself in a way to become popular, I think, in retrospect. But I enjoyed people and learning about them, and became curious about why people were so different. I had identical twin cousins, and I could tell them apart, but they dressed alike, and this was a fascinating thing to me. I didn't do a lot of the male macho kind of things that young men do. I was more studious and more courteous, and I played sports, but wasn't all that good. But I played on the first basketball team as a guard, and and an ability to shoot baskets from half court.
That's an ability.
Coach would put me in when they seemed like if he thought I was hot. Someday they'd be hot, and they'd all go in. So, and that kind of attention was I liked that. You know, outstanding in some way. So, I got reinforcement a lot of little ways like that. I became the editor of the yearbook for the senior class. And a friend of mine was the president and the senior class, and we worked together. And we went out and solicited ads and created the layouts for this yearbook. And for every little picture of every senior and junior, there was a little quote that was of your own making that had to go with it. One of them went, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I wanted to do research.
Interesting.
I knew that right then. So from then on, I think I must have known that in all my explorations of the environment that I wanted to know more.
Yeah, so the whole time you were sort of working toward that.
Yeah.
Even as you were graduating from high school, you understood that. Before we get you out of high school, there's something you told me, or I read it somewhere, but you wrote the weekly folk, F-O-O?
Weekly Foo.
Weekly Foo? What is the Weekly Foo?
There was a comic strip in the newspaper, Buffalo newspaper, called the Weekly Foo, the Daily Foo or something. There was I don't even know what the characters looked like, but they would... They're sort of like what you see in Mad Magazine, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And that really attracted me because they were far out kind of comments and sayings. And so for some reason, I had got this little printing press for Christmas or something. You just set the little rubber type in into this roller and then roll out a sheet of paper, 4x8 or 4x6. You would have whatever you wanted to put in it, and I don't remember what, I never saved any of that, but I used to have a little commentary on school life. And I don't know whether it probably was just very stupid.
So you graduated from high school, what year was that?
1944.
So you spent a good deal of your time growing up during the Depression, and then under the shadow of the Second World War.
Yes.
So how did the war, how did that impact on you after you left high school?
Well, I left high school, I was 17 and a half, 18, and there was a lot of war propaganda in the newspapers, and I was sinking of ships by German submarines, and images in the newspapers. We didn't have TV, of course, but the radio had bombarding all these messages about what the Germans are doing, what the Japs are doing, that kind of thing. And I became very patriotic. I got caught up in the propaganda. You know, I didn't think of it as propaganda. I thought it was real. These things are serious matters, and I wanted to go join the military, so I could participate in solving the world's problem, help conclude the war. And when I first told my mother, I remember this, I told her I wanted to join the army, and she said, "Oh, Wally," I said, "I want to go overseas and kill some Japs." And she was just dumbstruck by that commentary. And I don't remember my dad ever saying anything. But my dad was in the First World War, and he, every Memorial Day, or every Veterans Day, whatever they called it, in November 11th, when the First World War concluded, there was a day off. And after doing the chores, we'd come back to the house, and we would do, my dad was in charge of bands, town bands, and he was the conductor, the leader. And we would go off to some small town cemetery and march up there. And when I became proficient enough, I would play taps up on a hill in the cemetery. And very solemn occasions, I remember my dad would weep during those times, because he was in the battlefront as a first aid. I don't think he was sort of, what do they call it? You don't want to be in the military, but he wanted to do something.
Sort of not a conscientious objector.
Yeah, something
but
like that.
Something.
He joined the Red Cross.
Yeah, right.
And so he became, or he was actually part of the military band. And on the side he was, would go up in these ambulances and bring back wounded soldiers. He had an experience of coming across these pockmarked landscapes and finding a bunch of Germans willing to surrender with their hands behind their head. I've got a little newspaper clipping that tells about it. Maybe 12, 15 Germans, he marched them back to the U.S. headquarters, and he had a 45 Colt.
So he'd seen enough of war to be able to weep at the Veterans Day.
Yes.
Yeah, understood.
And even on days that we didn't do it, he didn't go out anywhere. He, at that hour, at that minute, he would go into this kitchen and just stand by himself and weep. Hmm. He never talked about it or any of that kind of stuff.
So, 18 years old, you want to join the military, you have that in mind, you talk to your folks, what happens, do you enlist at that point?
I enlisted, but I don't exactly remember how this was done, but my dad thought I should go to a military school. I think he had thought this earlier because I was so rebellious as a person on the farm. I didn't really want to do things that he wanted me to do. So he thought if I went to a military school, I'd get some discipline.
I see.
And so I applied to West Point.
That's a military school,
that's
all right.
Military school. And I didn't know anything about it. In order to do so, you had to go, you had to get some local town dignitary that was a guy who ran the local mill recommended me to the district congressman. His name was Wadsworth, to the U.S. Congress, and he's the one who could send my name in as a candidate. And he did that, and he had requests from other young men or their parents, and if you were chosen, you were either chosen as the principal, one first most likely to go, or a first alternate, mm-hmm. or a second alternate. Well, I was the first alternate. And you didn't know whether you were going to be chosen because until it came close to the time, mm-hmm. it turned out that the guy who was ahead of me did want to go at that time, and so he was chosen. But during that period, we had joined the military in order to be eligible for West Point, and they sent us as a special group, because we were West Point appointees, to Fort Dix for basic training, brief basic training. And then while we were waiting to hear whether we were appointed, we were sent to learn basic college subjects at Cornell University. Mm. So that's where I went. It was the closest university to our place. And I spent a quarter there learning chemistry, taking chemistry courses, just basic college courses.
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I did. I think I was sort of lost, but it was that kind of academic kind of thing. It appealed to me. Mm-hmm. That was in the fall of 47, something like that. Till December. At that point, when they found who was the first person from our district to be chosen for West Point, the rest of us were given the opportunity to go to one of the officer training schools. You choose anyone you want. And I chose the infantry school at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Any particular reason, infantry?
I think it didn't. It was low tech, I think. I didn't think of myself as a high tech person, and I wanted to be in the basic fighting level, ground troop type of thing. It seemed more. Quickest way to get into action.
I'm going to make a correction here. You'd said that This was in October of 47. You meant October of 44.
44,
okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I graduated in June 44.
Right.
And during that summer, I went to Cornell and then...
Then to Fort Benning, right.
Then to Fort Benning. Where are we here?
Okay. After you left Fort Benning, didn't you go to Fort Ord at that point?
Yeah, I got my second lieutenancy.
Mm-hmm.
Remember at that point, Roosevelt died, and that was a very sad time. For me, it was very sad. I think I was so patriotic and realized that he was a major commander. Then we got our graduated from Officer Candidate School in Infantry. I got a gold bar and I went home briefly to see my mother and dad, and then we were shipped by train to Fort Ord, which was a pre-debarkation point to prepare us. And we got little manuals. We were slated to go to the Philippine Islands to replace fighting soldiers because the war had ended at that point when I was still at Fort Benning. They gave us little pamphlets on how to speak Filipino language, which is a really, really big waste, I think. But then we took a train to San Francisco and got on a huge troop transport ship. I don't know what it was before, whether it was made for that purpose, but it took several thousand men. And we were stacked up on bunks in the hold. Because I was a second lieutenant, I had certain privileges. I would do watch duty on one of the decks. So I'd wander around, make routine checks of different parts of the ship on that deck. And I remember standing at the prow and watching the boat cut through the water of the Pacific Ocean. When we got out into the ocean, it was a beautiful purple, but at night, a lot of these fluorescent organisms, when they were disturbed, they would light up, and so you see them flashing in the wake of the ship, or in the bow flow of the ship. And I don't know how long that took, several weeks to get over there. We stopped at Midway Island. We stopped at Honolulu, I think, and then Midway Island, and then into Manila. And in Manila Bay, there was stacks and posts of ships that had been sunk in the bay, just sitting there. And it was bombed out buildings all over Manila. I think when General MacArthur moved in and conquered the Japanese troops who were stationed there, there was a lot of fighting there. Guadalcanal had been there, and we went north, we were trucked north to Clark's Field, which is an airfield, an infantry training post for their training. Our job was to train Filipino men to take the place of the American soldiers who had to ship back to the U.S. And because I was a second lieutenant, I got an administrative job. And at the headquarters, the training post. And I did guard duty while I was there for the post. And there was a lot of theft, stealing. Mm-hmm. Filipinos had nothing, were coming in and taking food and blankets, all kinds of things. Weapons were stored in our warehouse. And I had to stand guard in one of these little towers. And there were occasions when I could see people taking stuff, and I would call halt and shoot into the air, but I was in, it wasn't my character to do anything violent, so these things just happened.
How long did you end up being stationed in Manila?
I think I was there to in Clarksfield for about 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. And then when I got off the ship in Manila, coming from the U.S., those days I was in a big 4x4 truck standing against the railing, sleepy and staring off it in the area, and I saw a familiar figure. It was my cousin Virginia Wild, who just lived down the street from us in Darien Center, and she was a nurse. And I shouted her name, and she turned and came running over and jumped up at me, and I was the envy of all the other guys. She married a lieutenant who was a fighter, a bomber pilot. Mm. But she went back to the States and she learned that my father had died. Mm. And so she arranged to have me fly back to the U.S. Pentagon to get discharged. Mm. To work on the farm.
So two things that happened to you in the Navy of consequence, I mean many things of course, but in terms of your career, one was your experience at Cornell, actually taking these college courses and finding out a little bit of what college was all about.
Yeah, right.
And being introduced to that. And the second was, it sounds as if that voyage, that ocean voyage, was something that was important to you as well, seeing sort of the natural world from an ocean perspective.
Yeah.
As opposed to your farm background.
A major expansion of my, and then seeing the poverty and the different cultures in the Philippines, this is a major awakening.
So what are you thinking now? Obviously you're thinking about your father when you come back and that kind of situation, but where do you go?
My father and I were never close, and he was very rough on us kids, and when I called back from, when I flew back from Manila to Honolulu to San Francisco area, some airport base there, I called home and asked my sister. I had not learned at this point that my father had died.
Mm. Oh.
And my cousin had just arranged for me to get the discharge, come back and get the discharge. So I called home and my sister answered and I said, "How's Dad?" She said, "Oh, well, he died." Mm. And so it was unusual that I did not feel any emotion about that. But until much later, I think that I realized there was something in me that was walled off. And, so I went back to the farm and they gave me a month time off. It was in the fall or spring, I don't know exactly, but I got right to work on the farm with my brother, Neil, who was 4 years younger than I, and we did all the chores. It was a hired man who worked with us, and both Neil and I learned that this is not the life for us. We never learned anything about the farm. We never learned anything about crop rotation or, you know, when would you judge when a grain was ripe?
Right, right.
We just were not interested in those things, so we were both curious and playful. And So I went to Washington, D.C., and the Pentagon was built, and I wandered around in there to find the place, office, where I'd have to get my papers to be discharged. And I did that, and then I took a train back to Darien Center and continued doing the fall harvest. Then I realized I wanted to get to college. Obviously, the farm had nothing for me.
How did you decide? How did you go about picking a college? Now you had the GI Bill coming.
Yes. So, and I don't remember. Well, I had decided on the way back, on the way over, I guess, that I was interested in saving the world and doing something for humanity. Mm-hmm. These grand kind of views.
Probably not an unusual thought after what this world had just been through.
No, yeah. That's right. And it was a natural thing for me. And I met a young Mormon man on the way back whose life was dedicated to service. And he was about to go to, after he got out, he was going to go to Europe to do his duty for service in a foreign country. It's part of the Mormon practice, and a very gentle young man, and I was struck by that attitude. I also met another man who was a sort of a European descent, who his father was a foreign service officer or somehow involved with service the country. And so I don't remember what I read or what I thought that I should go to Washington, D.C. I'd been there and get my discharge. And I saw that there were two or three colleges there, and I somehow learned that American University was a major teaching location for careers in foreign service. And that's all I knew, foreign service, sure.
So was it this vague feeling in these two words that kind of put you in?
So I just said, okay, I've never thought things through ever beyond such immediate next steps. And I think my mind doesn't work that way. I always take what's immediately at hand and deal with it. So I applied to that college and a couple others, but I don't know what the others were. American University accepted me, and I went there and started getting my basic college education, which is, again, chemistry, zoology, and English, so forth, mathematics. And I spent 2 years there. I took a psychology course. A man by the name of Dalbir Bindra. He was an Indian descent, but he had taken, he'd got his PhD at Harvard, and a very bright guy, but he taught psychology using a basic text that was so clear and well arranged, so logically arranged, so that it made good sense to me to, it seemed like that was a fascinating thing, because I learned things about perceptual illusions and how what you saw was not necessarily what was really out there, but how the mind created things. So I became interested in the psychological perception and the inner workings of the mind. I took a course in philosophy, which made no sense to me at all. And the guy who taught it was an old guy who just spoke abstractly, it seemed to me, and I didn't even know whether I passed the thing. But I did so well in my psychology courses and my science courses that Dalbir Bindra, I don't always get the top grade in his courses, and advice that I go to someplace like the University of Chicago, where people were intellectually.
So that was his suggestion?
It was his suggestion. Not only that, he had a colleague from Harvard who was a young teacher there, young professor. Garth Thomas. And he, so I wrote the Department of Psychology there, and they invited me to come out, be interviewed, and I hitchhiked. And that was my main mode of travel. I was in Washington. I went Route 15 from Washington to near Batavia, and then west to Darien Center to home. My mother was alive and still on the farm, so I would go back and spend a little time there.
I suspect that hitchhiking would have been a fairly common mode of transportation, yeah, with all the GIs back.
Yeah, and, it was, and you'd be picked up by everybody. You know, I was dressed well, so I didn't look sloppy or slovenly. So I get rides with all kinds of folks, women that were just driving by, or the truck drivers, semis would pick you up.
So you headed for Chicago. Tell me a little bit about your initial years at UC.
Well, I hitchhiked out there for my interview, and they accepted me almost right on the spot. They said, anybody who's going to hitchhike out here. Sort of, yes, a dedicated person. I don't know what they're looking at in my academic.
Did you have any, like, reference from Delbar, what was his name?
Yeah, probably from Delbar Bindra.
Delbar Bindra.
I don't remember the details there, but I got to Chicago, and then I started over again with the basics of social psychology, the things that were big in Chicago. And then, of course, I did not get a degree at American University. I'd only been there 2 years.
Right.
And they didn't believe in getting bachelor's or master's degree in Chicago. They judged you as, if you're interested in, if you're a PhD material, which they apparently judged me as being that, they shot me right through.
Well, so you don't, you just get the one terminal degree,
yeah,
and never,
right.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
I got an apartment there, or I got the GI housing. It was some old barracks that they had on the midway of the Chicago campus that were devoted to veterans. And at that point, I had married a young woman from American University. She went with me. We were there at Chicago. And I, of course, plunged right into my studies. And I was not really ready to get married, I don't think, but somehow it happened. I started fooling around with other women, and she was with other men, and we got a divorce. And and I went on to graduate school, and took all kinds of courses.
When you went to graduate school, what were you thinking? What were you thinking of as obviously your foreign service days were still back in Washington. That was not going to be right vibe. But what were you looking at now for your graduate course?
I was looking at psychology, clinical psychology, and how the mind works. Perceptual psychology, psychophysics. And Garth Thomas, who was took as my sponsor, he was doing some experiments on in a dark room, you had spinning discs, and you'd, one color light would come in one eye, the other color light in the other, and you're looking for a central mixing. You see whether there was a green light here, whether a yellow light there, whether you saw green. Centrally. Hmm. And I don't remember what we did, but we sat for hours and hours in there just talking, and it was a great relationship with him. He was very friendly and funny, and he liked my style of learning, and so we were close friends. And I took a variety of other courses. I took a course in neuroanatomy with Heinrich Kluter, who was an old-time neuroanatomist who was interested in the brain, and he was eclectic. He lived in an attic, one of the biology buildings there. That's where the offices were, cluttered with books, and he had monkeys in his office. And I got to learn, got to experience quite well-known scholars who would come through and give talks. Bee guy, who was the bee guy? Von Frisch, Carl von Frisch, who studied the determined why, how bees would get to flowers and come back home and go back out, communicate to other bees where flowers are. He was there for a summer, and we had courses with him. And that kind of dedicated search for answers to mechanisms of behavior was obvious, you know, from the other professors were doing studies of rats, electroconvulsives. I think that's enough.
Hold on a second. Okay, we're back on.
Okay.
I should mention that Wally had knee replacement surgery, what, about 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
So we're, the ice pack just fell to the floor. Deal with that.
Now there's an 8-inch scar at the center, and here's a picture of the prosthesis they gave me to carry in my wallet. A big plastic piece and a big metal piece. And,
So we're back at Chicago. You were talking about the bee guy and...
Yeah, and other experimental sites. Chicago was experimentally oriented, and experiments were the way to answer questions. And,
Did you buy into that?
Yeah.
I mean, that was something that
yeah,
you really...
Yeah, made sense, and I... Because you would vary variables and look at the outcomes. And I learned the scientific method there and how you could arrange experiments. There's experiments with animals, there's experiments with psychophysics, human perception. I had learned that I could hypnotize my brother. I thought I'd read something in some book on how to hypnotize people, and my brother was very susceptible, and I could get him to be, I go back to Darien, I could get him to do all the somnambulistic
oh, really?
Tricks.
Interesting.
And make post-hypnotic suggestions so that after he had a clue to wake him up, some clue to wake him up, another clue or verbal signal to put him back into hypnotic trance. And they worked with him, and I read about it, but I never worked with my brother. I tried it with other people, but I couldn't get it to work. I was demonstrating this to my mother and my sister. It was scary to them. Mm. And I realized it was a kind of power capability that I didn't want to have. I'd never talked about it.
Oh, really?
Interesting. And maybe that it would still work. Hmm. But I haven't the slightest interest in trying.
Hmm. That's interesting.
But to get people to see things that weren't there, could do that post-hypnotic suggestion. So it was another twist on how the brain works,
yeah.
And which fell into my domain of curiosity.
Yeah. So are you starting to kind of zero in on the brain at this point?
I think so. I was not really exactly, I don't think I was consciously aware of this, but I was.
As you look back, you see that all of these,
they all fit together.
There was this kind of relationship,
yeah,
that centered around the brain. And
I took the course with this Kluver, who was a neuroanatomist, and we dissected pig brains and stuff like that. So I didn't see the direct relationship, but I.
So you didn't see the direct relationship, but you were fooling around with the different ingredients.
No. I had taken such a wide variety of courses in college. I took more than was necessary to get the degree. Only thing remaining was to do a dissertation research. And I think I was well into using alcohol then, I had no overall plan. I just was searching around, and there was a professor there whose name was Austin Reason, R-E-I-S-A-N. He was a primatologist. He had worked at the Yerkes Laboratory as a primate biology, studying the development of young chimpanzees. Terms of not only behavior but their morphological development, using the same kinds of tests that had been done by Arnold Gazelle and humans. And so he was doing that, and so he was familiar with Yerkes Laboratories of Primate Biology in Orange Park, Florida. I'd go down there every summer to study, make these measurements. He knew the people who were there. At that point, Carl Lashley, who was a older man at that time, but he was a major figure in neural studies. He had taken, he would aspirate in rats, part of the cerebral cortex, and it was fundamentally visual or auditory or somatic sensory or motor, and then study their behaviors and mazes and so forth. And he was a brilliant writer. He would make speculations about how the brain worked and how the mind worked. They were right on in some basis of his brilliance, I guess. But he was from Yale, I think. But Yale was managing the primate laboratories at that time. But on their staff in Florida was in Orange Park, where Keith and Kathy Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, had taking the challenge of taking an infant chimpanzee, and we're going to study it developmentally in their home. Mm-hmm. Try to teach it to speak language. So one of the first people who tried that, and they were in need of. The chimp was about 2.5 years old when my professor Austin Reason realized that they needed someone to work as a lab assistant, working with Vicky,
Vicky was the chimpanzee. Hold on one second.
Okay.
Before you started working with Vicky, what a great name for a chimpanzee.
Yeah.
You went to Wisconsin for a little bit first, right? Up the primate lab with
Harry Harlow.
Harry Harlow. Let's talk about that, and then we'll bring you back to Yerkes.
Well, I was at the University of Chicago, which wasn't very far away, and I don't know who suggested it, but I somehow contacted Harry Harlow, and he needed all kinds of young folks who were eager to do work on different projects of his own. And he invited me to come up for a summer, and while I was waiting for the opening to become available in Florida. During that summer, Frank Beach, who was a noted endocrinologist, zoologist, had been studying the role of hormones in producing different automatic behaviors in rats, and like different specific courtship behaviors or mating behaviors, and they were very instinctual and kind, and the role of different hormones on those behaviors. And so he'd become very famous and had written some book on endocrine control of behavioral patterns.
Was he at Wisconsin, or was he visiting?
No, he was from Yale, I think, or Harvard, and he came out for the summer to set up. We'd have our meetings up on Bascom Hill, up by the woods that goes off.
Upham Woods. What are those woods? Yeah, anyway, go ahead. Doesn't matter.
A grotto, I don't know what. But on the Mendota side of Bascom Hill. We'd sit around the grass or at a table, and I don't know what they were learning, but we're learning from him, a class of 15, 20 students. And it was an opportunity to learn from this specialist. And at the same time, I was working at the primate laboratory down the hill, not too far from the existing primate center.
Did you work directly with Harry Harwell?
Yeah, under his direction.
Tell me a little bit about him and your association with him.
Well, the first thing he required of me was to shave off my beard. It was not proper for his students to walk around with a beard. But he set me to work doing a project of studying how do you tame young monkeys. Bring them in from India, and you want to tame them so you can work with them to do learning experiments. And he was very famous at that point for having learned how monkeys learn. And my job was to try to acclimatize a large group of young monkeys, rhesus monkeys, to be tame and docile and teachable. And I did it just by working with groups in the same room. I'd sit in the cage with all these monkeys around, and I was learning how to horse whisperer kind of thing, getting to know their patterns and how I could tease them to do what I want them to do. And
so in a sense, communicating with them.
Yes. Yeah. Mostly just gestural and contact.
Did you find that they responded?
Yeah, it worked well. I had an affinity for animal behavior, so because I'd lived around it all my life, and I knew how to approach without scaring them, and how to subtly get them to do what I wanted them to do. That was one project, and then I set myself a couple other projects to study learning. Harry Harlow was becoming interested in exploratory behavior. And so he sent me to work to do something there, and my task was to see if I could get monkeys to learn about food reward. And so I had some screw eyes, you know, the things that hooks.
Yeah.
I'd screw them into the wooden panel and arrays, and I'd paint the different eyes different colors, two different sets of colors, and the holes were drilled such that one color you could pull it out directly, and the other one was screwed in tight so you couldn't pull it. So I was essentially, the monkeys were learning to use color to decide which thing they could move and get into their hands. And that was one type of experiment.
Were you able to be successful in that?
Yeah, I was successful. It worked, and when I showed it to Harry Harlow, he put one of his graduate students to work on that kind of a project, and they went on to publish. It was one of their first studies of using exploratory motives to produce learning in monkeys.
Did you get footnoted in that at all?
No. I was not interested in that or able to promote myself. And then the time came, this summer was coming to an end, and that's when my professor at Chicago's
made the suggestion.
Suggestion of going to Yerkes, and I sort of pleaded with him. I didn't know what to do. I was sort of lost. I passed all my courses, but I had to do a research project. And this opening as a project assistant to the Hayeses for working with Vicki, he knew about that, and he suggested that maybe that I could do that. And I just said, yeah, sure. And so he recommended me, and I went down there, and I drove down, and Hayes had a barn-like house. That bottom floor had, the room had windows that was wire mesh, so that Vicki was getting strong at that time, so she could jump, kick, and so there couldn't be a window. There had to be some kind of device to prevent her from getting out. So, and I lived upstairs. It was an apartment upstairs, and I lived up there. And after working with Vicki for about assigned times, I'd go up to the primate lab, which was about a mile and a half up the road in the woods. And there's several acres of caged buildings, and the chimps of different ages were housed, and there was a large building that was the administration building where Carl Lashley was the director, and Henry Nissen was another major primatologist who was there. And he took me under his wing in a way, because Austin Reason had to go back to Chicago to teach. And so I was working with the Hayeses, and but I had half a day free to do whatever I wanted. And so I thought I'd carry on this study of exploratory behavior with chimps. An idea. I hadn't had the slightest idea what to do, so I would just put things up against the wire mesh and see what it is that interested them. They would grab whatever I put up. And it somehow occurred to me to prepare a table. I'd push up against the cage and they could stick their hands out to the mesh and young chimps and touch objects. And I built in different textures and different surfaces, different shapes. Some objects are movable, other ones that look the same were not movable. And so I was trying to experiment to see what features would interest chimpanzees. And they were what you'd expect. The movable object that she could want to play with that. And round object, a big ball I'd made out of wood, and it was colored, painted, and the chimps would spend a lot of time just rubbing around it. And I had another one which similar size, it was had sandpaper surface, and they behaved differently to that. They'd pick at it. So I just did some simple-minded kind of choices that they could use.
So these were based a lot on your observations of their behavior.
And so I just learned more about the chimps and what it is that interested them. And they're very curious animals and very playful. And so the limitations of them being in a cage and me presenting stuff outside the cage, I did as much as I can. I had a number of setups where they could make choices. And I was working with Vicky, which was sort of free form. And she'd go in her room and she'd grab me and pull me up on the couch and jump up and down on my knee. And I don't really know what I did except just to be there with her when the Hayes would go do something else. I was sort of a caretaker. I did some simple experiments of creating objects that she'd have to reach into and feel and do different things, but they weren't too successful or produce any experimental results. She was so wild, it was so active, it was hard to channel her. And so I worked. The experiments I did at the laboratory were the ones that created the data that went into my dissertation. And so I prepared the dissertation according to the standards at the University of Chicago. And Kate Tarabian is the standard bearer for style and how the margins is right and so forth. So I prepared this dissertation and went up to take the oral exam.
Oral defense, yeah.
The oral defense. And there were a number of people that not only Austin Reason, but Garth Thomas and some other professors who I got to know. Plus, surprise to me, it was Carl Rogers, who was the non-directed psychologist therapist.
Right. Had you known him before from your study?
No, I think I knew he was there, but I didn't. I was surprised to see him show up at my thesis, and he was quite impressed with the fact that someone would want to study play and exploration, because no one had done anything like
really?
That.
Really? Yeah. Really? That's interesting.
So, I got my degree.
You studied play and observation. Tell me what your findings were, the general nature of the kinds of things you learned that Carl Rogers, for example, might have been interested in.
Well, novel objects were very attractive. So I'd had a whole series of sets of objects that would, and if I put the same objects, I'd put the same objects before the chimps, six different animals, I think, over several days, and their interest in them lessened, so there was a habituation. from the curb. And I counted the number of touches and the number of seconds they spent touching the objects or looking at them. And a data sheet that would record looks versus touches versus durations. A stopwatch to make some quantification to it. So after they habituate interest to one set of objects, I'd bring another set the next day, and interest would go back up to a higher level. Again, they would habituate. Mm-hmm. So maybe 6 to 10 different sets of novel objects, the same thing occurred. And so that was a effect of novelty was very great. And then there were certain other features of objects that I call preferences, that they preferred to touch angular object versus a smooth one, a rough one versus a smooth one, and a larger one versus a smaller one, a movable one versus a similar looking object that was not movable. They all had to be built very sturdily because they tried to break whatever you put before them. So I learned a lot about the chimps and their capacities and their talents and their how to do testing of them. I wrote all that up in this dissertation.
What was your PhD in then?
In the Department of Psychology.
In psychology, so yeah. It was the psychology.
Right.
Okay.
And it was so simple-minded. I look at it now. It was just embarrassing. No one could ever get a degree doing that kind of work.
But it was very different, was it not?
It was different, and it impressed the scholars who were on my committee. But I didn't know up from down. That I just was playing myself.
Before we go with where you went from there, you mentioned earlier that the Hayeses, Keith and Kathy, were trying to teach the chimpanzee to talk. Did they ever?
No, all they could get was guttural utterances and lip smackings and things like that. I guess what people have found since then, too. Gestural language is their main mode of communication. She had all kinds of hand gestures and body movements that would tell the Hayeses what she wanted.
Was this kind of the heyday of primate research?
Yeah, it was the beginning of a study of the great apes. Yerkes himself had done some of the early studies, and he's the one who set up this laboratory down there, Robert Yerkes. But he was retired by the time I got there. And at that time also, Carl Lashley was...
Oops. Go ahead.
Yerkes was the behaviorist or the taxonomist, the person interested in similarities between apes. Actually, he had been involved in the development of IQ tests for the Army military.
Oh.
And that was one of his major efforts during the war. He was sort of retired by then, but I remember looking at the reprint files. There were a number of papers that he had done by. They weren't in the line of experimental thing, they're more descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a young man named K. L. Chow, C-H-O-W, Chinese. Who also was from Harvard and knew Garth Thomas and Dalbavina. But he was down there, he was interested in taking out brain bits in monkeys, see how they performed on two choice discrimination tests of various kinds, delayed reward, and more subtle variations of tests than Harlow had used. Harlow wasn't doing any brain stuff. It was just a purely behavior.
Mm.
Um, But in your case, they were doing brain studies and mostly by removing bits and see what happened.
Did you participate, watch that, get involved in that in any way?
Only peripherally. I stood in a sterile surgery with Carl Preblum. At one point, he would come down from some university at Westwood. Came down, he did some frontal lobotomies. That was the time when they were doing lobotomies in humans. And they were doing those in chimps and seeing how it affected them. And the sterile surgery I stood in with him, he was doing it, these kind of things on monkeys. I got to watch that kind of thing. It was easy for me to, being raised on a farm where you slaughtered animals and so forth, those things went up. So, there was several, when I read the literature that people were writing about brain extirpations and the effect on maize performance in rats and cats and monkeys, and it's like the early days of experimental studies of the brain using this crude technology of lopping off bits of brain tissue. Electrodes were being used at that time to record or stimulate. And, but I was sort of just glancing at the edge of those old brain kind of stuff. And then after my 2-year tour of duty down there, I got my degree, and I asked Carl Ashley and Henry Nissen what I thought I should do, and they still didn't have an idea.
You tell me.
They had seen what I'd done and realized I was interested in the brain, and I expressed that, I guess, interested in brain and behavior in the general field, and they suggested coming to Wisconsin to work with Clint Woolsey. Woolsey got here in 1938, and I did it in 1953 or so, and I came up to Wisconsin in 1954.
Had you heard of Woolsey before this?
Not really.
So just a name that you might have been familiar with, but you didn't have any real...
Right, I didn't know what he'd done or what he was doing.
Did you go up there for an interview or
how? Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And did you meet Woolsey at that point in time?
Yes, I did. I wrote a letter telling him that what I was interested in. I later saw the letter. It was just so crude and simplistic. I told him I was born on a farm and raised on a farm, and I was interested in animals and so forth, and he accepted me.
What were your first impressions of Woolsey when you met him in person?
I was respectful of him. I didn't really have any knowledge of what he'd been doing, I don't think. And I just knew that he was going to work with me on an apprenticeship basis, participating in experiments.
Now, just a few more questions, then we'll leave you at Wisconsin. We'll start there next time. So when you went up there, did you have much of an idea of what you were going to be doing?
No.
Were you going to be doing what Woolsey essentially told you to do, or were you going to come up with a program? How did that work?
I was
going
to do whatever. I wanted to learn what I didn't know.
Okay.
So that's the way I usually approach things. And I spent some time at the primate lab because I had that previous contact with Harry Harwell, so I did some behavioral studies down there. But I also worked half time with Woolsey and with Harry Harwell.
When you first got there, you worked with Harlow as well?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about that a little bit. Well, let's just get you there for now.
Okay.
And then we'll pick it up there. Next time we'll be talking about the Department of Neurophysiology, and we'll just pick up the story then.
I stopped that summer between when I went to Wisconsin, when I finished at Yerkes, I had written to Yale, I think, an ichthyologist who was running the Bimini Laboratories in Marine Laboratories on the island of Bimini, and on the other side of the Gulf Stream. And I married my second wife at that time, and she and I went out there, another couple, just to do research for a month during whatever. We spent a lot of time scuba diving or snorkeling around in the green edges of the island, and just looking at just an amazing variety of creatures and colors and fish, squid, and eels, and just becoming familiar with this expanse of underwater life. And we would bring creatures into the tanks that the marine labs had, all kinds of tanks you could do experiments with. And people who regularly worked there during the year were gone because it was coming hurricane season. Mm-hmm. And it was, people were going back to their regular jobs. So we were accepted to come there to do whatever we wanted. That's what we did. We just did whatever we wanted.
This was when? This was?
At the end, after I'd gotten my degree.
This is between then and your start at Wisconsin?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. Perfect place to start. Stop. We'll pick it up probably next week. Same place.
Okay.